Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. So now, here we are at the first day of August in the 19th year of this adolescent millennium. August is the second Caesarean month of the year. August is also the advent of my personal new year. It is my birth month. August's namesake, the Roman Emperor Caesar Augustus, died on my birthday 2,005 years ago on August 19th in the year 14 AD at age 75. August is the month the nuclear age got its start 74 years ago with the dropping of two atomic bombs on Japan. That same August 1945, Vietnam declared independence from the revival of French colonialism, which followed Japan's surrender at the end of World War II, which culminated in a generation of wars against two Western powers. In August 1964, a fabricated incident that involved two American destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin, the first tomorrow, 55 years ago on August 2nd, led to a virtual declaration of war by the United States a few days later. That war, and most particularly the peace movement that arose to protest it, are the subjects of today's program, which I dedicate to a few local visionaries of that era of peace, love, and utopia, who two decades later founded public radio station KMUN, and to Vietnam Veterans Against the War. I combine two spiels of my own, the first an abbreviated rant to end the war, which I made 50 years ago in 1969, in late July. Just say no to the war. 50 years ago, in July 1969, I proposed that the city of Long Beach, California, withdraw from the Vietnam War. A few months earlier, the Ohio city of Beallsville, which had lost seven of its young men killed in the war, attempted to do the same thing, but was denied the opportunity by the state government and President Richard Nixon, which claimed no individual city has the legal right to remove itself from a war. I made my proposal at the first session of a recently re-elected city council. I don't know how many local government bodies were addressed about the war or how successful they might have been. I chose Long Beach because I worked for a newspaper there, and it was a major port for sending troops to Vietnam in the war's early years and continued to extensively resupply it by ship. It was also my embarkation point to the war as a U.S. Marine. I told the council that I was not speaking as a member of the press, but as an American citizen. It probably seems as hopeless a gesture in retrospect as it did then, but I thought it was necessary to do, whatever the outcome, and five decades later, after a few later wars, I still do. I am sure, and this is my address to the council, I am sure that some of you know that for a time I was a Marine and fought with the infantry as a combat correspondent for a year in Vietnam. If you were to ever research the record, you will find my claim to be true, and you will notice that I had ample opportunity to reach some quite basic conclusions from firsthand experience. I was able to catch with my mind and camera almost every type of example of our involvement in that nation. What I saw and took part in was generally quite the opposite of what is portrayed here at home through the media and the rhetoric of our more hawkish politicians. Ironically, I started the voyage to war from Long Beach, so it is personally appropriate for me to ask of you a decision of great importance, the answer of which will probably stamp you as the birds you shall grow to be in the next 3 years, hawks or doves. I am giving you a chance to publicly and specifically support or not the war in Vietnam, and I am demanding of you as a citizen and a veteran to tell me the reason for the decision you reach, and that it be concise and knowledgeable, not filled with ambiguous rhetoric. If you support the war because it has brought more money and bigger paychecks into this city, then have the honesty to say so. But if you support this war because of the vague threat of communism, then I want your knowledgeable reasons why the slaughter of another race in a faraway country and why close to 40,000 American soldiers have died is realistically preventing world domination by a political, military, industrial complex we have made hostile to our own. And if you are against the war, then I equally demand a concise answer. But that would probably be forthcoming at any rate because of the pressure that would be the result of that decision, a pressure that would not exist if you choose the prevalent one that has caused the war. This past 8 months, I have seen you, in your role as the previous consul, squabble about the Queen Mary, which the city purchased for a waterfront hotel and tourist mall, airport expansion, city hall plans, tax collecting and revenue bonds, prostitutes, hippies, rats, and cockroaches, sometimes the latter in the same breath. Never have I heard you discuss the Vietnam War. Yet you represent, in the myth of democracy, the mainstay of American government, the small community upon which falls the burden of providing the taxes and muscles of our federal government. And especially are you in that position, since Long Beach is one of the central clearing stations and disembarkation points from which the fodder and cannon goes to Vietnam. Yet, I would wager a bag of the rice we export to Vietnam because the war has wiped out its rice crop, that you can't answer a few basic questions about why or how this technological superpower sent the legions of In God We Trust and an archangel warehouse of machine guns and napalm against a tiny nation of fishermen and farmers. How many of you are familiar with Article 6 of the Geneva Accords? What started the Viet Minh War against the colonial French, and why did the Viet Minh win it? Why do the Vietnamese distrust and even hate the Chinese? Who was Ngo Dinh Diem, and where did he come from? Why did the Vietnamese besiege the American base, Marine base at Con Tien for so long? What really happened in the Tonkin Gulf? Do any of you have answers to these questions? If you do not, why not? You have helped send almost 40,000 Americans to their deaths and more than a million Vietnamese. You have taken the word of only a few men and helped commit a generation of young Americans to a slaughter, both of themselves and the civilization of another race. And why have you done it? To stop communism. What is communism? You probably don't even really know, except you think it threatens your wallets. If you cannot answer these questions concisely, then you are criminals. If you can answer them, your participation in these war crimes is all the more indicting. If you say it is your duty to support and follow, then the hangman's rope awaits you as it did the Germans and Japanese, who gave the same excuse at Nuremberg following World War II. If your plea is ignorance, the answers to all of those questions and a thousand more are available. They have been for years, and perhaps because of that ignorance, you have robbed the young men passing through this city by the thousands who will kill and perhaps die by never giving a straight answer as to why they must do these things. It is your responsibility. You have set yourselves up as minor leaders thirsting for ever greater political prestige. You are the grassroots authority of all that America claims to stand for. By evading that responsibility, you have relinquished civilian constitutional control to the forces of the military, which conduct themselves through a dictatorial type of system. These forces strip their members of their constitutional rights as citizens, claiming the necessity of discipline and obedience, and regard the body politic itself with the same arrogance. It is particularly your responsibility because these forces chose as their instruments two Navy destroyers based in Long Beach, USS Maddox and USS Turner Joy, to start the whole thing. Those two vessels were purportedly attacked by North Vietnamese torpedo boats in August 1964, and as a result, President Lyndon Johnson rammed the Tonkin Resolution through Congress. 4 years later, crewmen from those destroyers testified to a Blue Ribbon U.S. Senate committee that they fired first, and that they saw no torpedoes heading toward their ships, and that they had been sworn to secrecy by their officers for security, quote-unquote, reasons. Those facts and thousands more are available in almost every library or bookstore, perhaps even the library across the street from City Hall. Gentlemen, these past 8 months covering the City Council as a news reporter have shown me great paradoxes. You demand home rule, yet deny it to the Vietnamese people. You have, in your silent support, helped destroy every movement in that direction. You play to the so-called silent majority, yet you suppose the Vietnamese to be either for Saigon or Hanoi, no middle ground, and allow the wrong answer of allegiance or a principle of no allegiance to mean death or prison to him or his family. You ask the college radicals in this country what they intend to replace our political system with, yet you help destroy Vietnamese society, offering only a corrupt and brutal dictatorship as replacement. And you well know that instead of burning down American colleges, you demand the students enlist or be drafted into the armed forces to burn up Vietnam instead. I have demanded an answer of support or not for the Vietnam War, but now I am asking in the light of truth to risk the $500 million a year you receive from the U.S. Navy and publicly say this war has been conducted through willful and shameful ignorance and that a grave and tragic error has been made, that the result of the war have split this nation and alienated an overwhelming number of our youth, which makes up a full 50% of our population, that whatever results were to be gained by fighting this war have been engulfed in disastrous consequences that are exploding across our land, that because of this war, hate, deceit, and fear have become the order of the day. Demagogues of all callings shout for violence and bloodshed, whether in the holy names of God, liberty, anti-communism, or revolution, and that the terror and horror of a new civil war might just be beginning. That because of the Vietnam War, the most intelligent of an entire generation have concluded that you have lied to them about the war, and as a result have probably lied to them about everything else, and that it is imperative to recognize, understand, and correct these ills, starting with the cessation of the Vietnam War that is splitting our nation apart and continuing through the myriad evils of racial and gender prejudice, poverty, and hunger. I ask you to admit that nothing is honorable or can be escaped with honor when it was begun through deception and dishonor. I ask you to put a stop to the slaughter, that peace begin here with you. The word peace makes the most eminent of men cringe. It is as if peace as well as love are only in the realm of the hippie, a way of life men such as you righteously oppose. You make laws to prevent our young from being addicted to the psychedelic mushroom, yet you sponsor and support the insane and suicidal addiction to the mushroom cloud. The council before you had a chance to thoughtfully consider and support a proposal for peace, an international peace song festival that might have involved children from all over the world gathering here in Long Beach, but refused the idea out of hand. Yet that council supported every war-inspired proposal that came before it. Though the appeal from Beallsville, Ohio earlier this year to withdraw from this war was denied by President Richard Nixon, that is only a small farming community. How do you think the president would treat the same request from a great naval port such as this? Perhaps this is just another useless gesture, but at least it will be on record for others to see, and they will know that you once had an opportunity to do something possibly noble and courageous, as well as being the right thing to do, that you could have picked up and carried the torch of peace, and you could have said from the very beginning of your 3-year reign reelected, and you could have said that you want peace in this world and will strive to save the race of humanity from its own senseless suicide. And that was something that I wrote and said, and I lost my job over in the newspaper I worked for. I call it Just Say No to the War. And now, Summers of Love and War, which I wrote and have read on previous programs, Rideau, Rideau, and Rideau, and which is primarily focused on the summers of 1967 and 1968. The summer of 1969, 50 years ago this summer, can be characterized in contrasts as Woodstock and its evil nemesis, Helter Skelter. Summers of Love and War. All sorts of people clogging America's retirement system are reminiscing about the summer of 1967, which they call the Summer of Love, a drug-induced hallucination in which several thousand, mostly pampered and upper-class white flower children, briefly abandoned social structure and sang, danced, and fornicated like most of us imagine our wild and unfettered ancestors to have done in the primeval veldt before civilization and Christianity dampened our freewheeling pagan spirits. Mecca, that legendary summer 52 years ago, was San Francisco, Baghdad by the Bay, historic incubator and refuge for many radical and eccentric mythologies. For an ephemeral moment in a nation torn apart by an unpopular war and racial strife, a quicksilver of fun and peace rippled through the stoned young masses who had swarmed into the city from all over the country with heads swaddled in blossoms. A song that summer urged westward-bound immigrants, if you go to San Francisco, wear a flower in your hair. An ad hoc socialist republic boomed and bust as rapidly as an old gold rush town. Everything seemed free for the asking. Food, lodging, medical care, sex and wine, even the psychedelic drugs that fueled the dreamlike vision of a world of harmony, peace, and love. It all went badly quickly, of course. Before the summer was over, evil spirits had merged with the blithe, frolicking throngs of nirvana seekers, stealing, assaulting, and raping, selling toxic drugs, and generally creating an infection of bad vibrations. The rhapsodies of nostalgia about that long ago and faraway summer seemed to ease over the ruthless struggle of that period. That same summer of 1967, American cities burned with racial hatred and insurrection, also despair. More than 200 other young Americans were dying in Vietnam every week, and God, Buddha alone knows how many thousands of Vietnamese were killed between each Sunday and Saturday. The dream world itself soon darkened into a nightmare. Two summers later, the counterculture that grew from the summer of love, simultaneous with its final fling of Woodstock, produced its most infamous citizen, Charles Manson. The 1960s are set apart from other decades. They are different not so much for their intensity, the World War II years of the 1940s were far more intense, or because they were more flamboyant and colorful, the jazz age of the 1920s had more flash, or for that matter, because they were fueled by division and insurrection, the 1770s and 1860s make better claims. The significance of the 1960s is the example provided by the nation's indulgence in its youth, or more, perhaps more aptly, with a single immensely large generation of young people who responded by paradoxically souring on the nation at a time of unparalleled prosperity. The 1960s were a tumultuous period. The civil rights movement of primarily Southern blacks gave rise to a white civil insurrection movement of mainly disaffected youth who protested an unpopular and ill-conceived war that forced young males to fight and possibly be crippled or die. For the most part, the children of the working classes went quietly into induction and the war, and most of the nearly 60,000 dead and several hundred thousand wounded came from their homes. Primary opposition to the war came from the nation's middle-class youth. As usual, upper-class whites were protected and could avoid service in the war, although many went into service, typically as officers, in particular pilots, or were engaged in anti-war protest. Rampant ideologies and social solutions were conceived and died in the turbulent years of that decade. Revolution was a serious and futile flirtation, a malevolent and adolescent reaction against a paternal system that refused reform or criticism. Young Americans turned to animistic socialism. A new left replaced the old left and developed a political philosophy that loosely resembled Gypsy Law. They thought they could bind state socialism and social control with a tribal sense of individual freedom. The police and military showed the young resistors to authority that social change takes hard work and great pain, which few were inclined to exert. Reality, which means that all dreams take time for fruition and are modified by reality, disillusioned the young once more. The now generation found some other nows to be now about. A frustrated few tried to push against history, but most were mostly killed or hunted into jail. Accidental explosion of homemade bombs literally wasted some of the best and brightest. If the 1967 Summer of Love and Flower Power was a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale for the young baby boomers, 1968 was surely a tale by the Brothers Grimm. It was a torrid year of assassinations, vainglorious battles in the overseas war, and increasingly violent anti-war demonstrations, generally set off by police and National Guards armed with clubs, guns, and gas. The 1968 presidential campaign, which pitted Democrats Eugene McCarthy and Robert Kennedy against the war as well as against each other, failed to change anything. Republican Richard Nixon was elected most likely as a result of Kennedy's assassination minutes after he won the California Democratic primary. Nixon despised the young protesters and attacked them more viciously than ever. 2 years later, culminating in the shooting deaths of four white students at Kent State by the Ohio National Guard and at least two blacks, both women, shot by police at Jackson State University in Mississippi. The government also staged a number of show trials of anti-war activists in the late 1960s and early 1970s, but juries acquitted them all. In 1969, anti-war radicals responded to police murders of Black Panthers and arrests of activists by forming a violent vanguard that proclaimed the beginning of revolution, the Weathermen, later Weather People, whose rhetoric was always considerably more revolutionary than their acts and whose homemade bombs blew up in their faces. But 1968 was also a year when an international youth movement might have linked. Not since 1848 had Europe been so united behind barricades. France, West Germany, Czechoslovakia, the Prague Spring, and in Mexico at the 1968 Olympic Games, and Chicago, USA, on our side of the world. Revolutionary politics are generically saturated with hoped-for might-have-beens. No connection was made among the internationalists other than sympathetic, though often inflamed, oratory. In 1968, the war in Vietnam reached its most dramatic and painful peak. The Winter Tet Offensive by North Vietnamese armies and Viet Cong guerrillas, which included the long and bloody siege at Khe Sanh, reminiscent of Dien Bien Phu 14 years earlier. 1968 was the moral low water mark of the war, the devastation of the ancient imperial city of Hue, and the slaughter of civilians by American soldiers at My Lai. President Lyndon Johnson surrendered his presidency to the war in 1968, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. sacrificed his life, organizing poor blacks and whites against the economic system that impoverished them. Robert Kennedy, brother of the assassinated President John Kennedy, campaigned for the presidency on a promise to end the war and provide justice to the poor, would probably have been elected if he had not been murdered in June. In August 19, the peak was also reached in the anti-war movement at the violent spectacle of the Democratic Party's National Convention in Chicago. The whole world was watching. Although culturists claim the 1960s got into swing around 1968, the theme of the decade was set at its start with the Black Civil Rights Movement. Not only did the violent and passionate search for racial justice inspire anti-war revolutionary New Left, earliest leaders of the movement were tempered by their own personal involvement in civil rights in the American South, registering blacks to vote, marching with blacks, and sharing the violent reaction. The other major influence was the Vietnam War, which provided the ignition point of youthful, mostly white rebellion, and added hardened, disaffected veterans of the war to the largely college-oriented movement opposing it. The veterans, like the civil rights activists, were experienced with violence and capably reacted to attacks by police and state militias attempting to quell the revolt against national policy. Veterans who crossed political lines to oppose the war that seasoned and repelled them became immersed in leftist ideology, although many did not approve of it. Yet the political right had failed them, had inducted them into an unholy war cloaked in righteous deceit, made them prisoners of conscience. Whereas the early New Left had been inspired by the civil rights movement and embraced liberation philosophies, the veterans came into the anti-war movement angry and embittered. Most of the veterans had a limited focus that ultimately was fatal to their campaign, far short of its goal to end the war. Similar to the majority of New Left organizations, Vietnam Veterans Against the War was at first stimulated by argument, but eventually debate and disagreement degenerated into quarreling animosities that broke the group apart. All that survived were two mutually hostile splinter groups that orbited a far and exotic fringe. The U.S. government's most powerful counterstroke was to virtually end the military draft, which almost immediately defused the rebellion. Draft-age males, assured of avoiding combat service, lost interest in the immorality of the war and also stopped thinking and talking about ideas and issues that grew from the war. Only diehards and incurable idealists persisted against the new wave of apathy driven by hopeful or grim visions. The New Left dissipated into a pablum of New Age kitsch. There were always contradictions among the countercultures of the 1960s. Hip culture chasing a buck in contrast to politicized hippies who wanted to abolish wealth. Nirvana seeking acid heads versus hardcore speed freaks and junkies. But everybody was against and in fear of the cops. The summer of love was the generation's iridescent mirage, the watershed of its vanished youth. They were born after World War II, and their memories don't include the daily sounds of bombers and bombs that tormented and killed children all over the world a few years earlier. Yet their continuing angst is a legacy of their parents' war. They were born under the sign of the mushroom cloud. The baby boomers grew up with the baby bomb. Duck and cover was the metaphor of their youth. More than the rebellion against prosperity and its flaccid corruption of spirit, their dread of nuclear holocaust defined their passionate protest against the Vietnam War, more even than personal fears of young males that they would be drafted into it. This first nuclear generation, also the first TV generation, felt a shared stake in the future, and apart from hype and herd instinct, they tried to be kind to one another. They are so large a generation they crash through history as irresistibly as fire, remaking everything they sweep past. They are so accustomed to the attention of society, even now in their millennial twilight, they believe they are the force of history itself. This is Michael McCusker. 400 years ago, on July 30, 1619, the colony of Virginia established the House of Burgess, the first legislative assembly in British colonial America, by an election of all free and presumably white adult males. From the House of Burgess, Virginia, in tandem with Massachusetts colony, fomented the American Revolution a century and a half later. Also on July 30th, 45 years ago in 1974, the U.S. House Judiciary Committee voted to impeach President Richard Nixon for defying subpoenas in the Watergate cover-up. Happy August.